Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 21st of February. We talk about Iran at this hour of the program. There are lots of developments. Iran has announced that it's holding military exercises to boost protection of its nuclear sites. A military statement from the government said the drills would be held in southern Iran to counter all possible threats, especially to public, important, and nuclear centers. And there has been speculation that Israel may launch a military strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Israel is pushing for tougher sanctions on Iran, but is saying that it is keeping all options open. Also, UN nuclear inspectors started a two-day visit to Tehran yesterday, seeking to meet Iranian nuclear scientists and to visit a key military facility as they try to gauge allegations that Iran is pushing toward making an atomic weapon. This trip is the second in less than a month by the International Atomic Energy Agency team. We have two guests with us this hour who will shed light on what's going on in that country. Barbara Slavin is joining us the first part of this hour, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center, Washington correspondent for a new website devoted to the Middle East, AlMonitor.com. Ms. Slavin is the author of a 2007 book on Iran that is titled Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. She's former assistant managing editor of the Washington Times, senior diplomatic reporter for USA Today, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, and editor at the New York Times. She's lived in Russia, China, Japan, and Egypt, and is a regular commentator on U.S. foreign policy on National Public Radio, the Public Broadcasting System, and C-SPAN. And she has visited Iran several times as a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Later this hour, Dilshad Ashlov will join us, assistant professor of political science at East Tennessee State University. We will be welcoming your phone calls, as we always do. And here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Barbara.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for being with us. We have so much to talk about this hour. There's so much going on in Iran. Let's start with the inspectors who arrived yesterday. Is there any hope that they will be able to find out what exactly is going on with the nuclear program in Iran?
Well, they already know a great deal about what is going on with the nuclear program in Iran. I mean, that's the good news, is that there has been regular access, at least to a number of facilities where Iran is enriching uranium. And so we have a sense of how much they have and how efficient they are at making it. The reason for this particular visit, though, is that they're trying to get answers to questions that have been outstanding for a number of years about possible military dimensions of the Iranian nuclear program. This is research that Iran did, particularly in the late 90s and up till 2003, into how to make a warhead, how to actually build and test a nuclear weapon. So that's what they're trying to get to the bottom of. I'm less optimistic that they will, but, you know, one can hope that Iran, being under such intense economic pressure, might begin to answer some of these questions.
Have they given any indication, Iran, that they will give those answers to the questions?
Not so far as I know. I mean, we've only seen rather general statements, but this is the second visit of this particular team in less than a month. And that in itself is good news. We are hoping also for perhaps a round of negotiations with the international community at some point in the next month or so, and that is also good news.
Mm-hmm. You have written about the European Union phasing out purchases of Iranian oil by July 1st. Tell me about other economic sanctions that are in place and what this decision at the end of January to phase out purchases of the oil is doing to Iran, making them a lot more likely to talk?
Well, possibly. I mean, Iran is under unprecedented economic pressure now. It's not just that the Europeans are cutting back and phasing out their purchases of oil from Iran. The most potent sanctions have been sanctions imposed by the United States that affect Iran's financial system. As of about a month ago, the United States put into place sanctions that basically forbid banks that do business with Iran's central bank from having anything to do with American banks and therefore the entire financial global financial infrastructure, which, you know, is denominated largely in dollars. This is huge. Basically, Iran is having terrible problems getting paid in hard currency for any oil that it sells. And, of course, it relies on oil to finance its operations. So this is really a very, very tough set of sanctions. Increasingly, also, companies are not, European companies are no longer investing in improving Iran's oil and gas infrastructure. So Iran's production will go down. Basically, Iran is relying more and more on China, Turkey, India, a handful of other countries, and it's having to resort to barter agreements because hard currency can't change hands.
Really? What do they barter for?
Well, in the case of China, they provide oil, and China provides all kinds of consumer goods and also a variety of services, construction work and so on. The Chinese have been building the Iranian metro in Tehran and doing other kinds of construction projects. Indians are providing rice to Iran, and so it's becoming rather primitive. And of course, Iran pays in the sense that this is not very efficient, and it's really losing out. But it has no choice if it wants to keep its system afloat.
And I don't know how you get a clear picture of how people in Iran are responding to this, but are there people who are very upset? Are they looking at the government and saying, we don't like what you're doing?
Yes, indeed. I mean, you know, basically people are facing a lot of difficulties, certainly getting hard currency. There was a run on the Iranian currency. It's lost more than half its value just in the last 3 months. People are panicking. They're buying gold. They're stockpiling all sorts of consumer staples. Inflation is very high. The government does not release accurate figures, but it's certainly well over the 20-30% range. The price of meat has doubled. And, you know, Iranians are going to be having their New Year. Nowruz comes up in March, and it's going to be a pretty bleak one, I think, for a lot of people. Even though the government provides cash subsidies to help with all of this, those cash subsidies are not keeping pace with rising prices.
Why hasn't there been, and maybe there is, and we just don't know about it, or I don't, Barbara, an Arab Spring kind of movement in Iran?
Well, there was. It just happened before the Arab Spring. It happened in 2009 when there were fraudulent presidential elections. You may remember 3 million people came out on the streets of Tehran after those elections in the summer of 2009. And there were a number of demonstrations that followed for the next 6 months until the government basically was able to crush them through a variety of brutal means, arresting thousands of people, executing some people, putting security services on the streets every time there was a potential day when there might be a demonstration. Just a couple of days ago, February 14th, Tehran was on complete lockdown because there had been demonstrations the previous February 14th, and there was a concern that people would come out on the streets again to mark that date. So the reason you haven't seen more unrest is because of incredibly efficient repression. Iranians are not yet willing to risk their lives en masse to get rid of this government. They had a revolution 33 years ago. It didn't turn out so well. So I think they're understandably cautious. But there is tremendous ferment. And people are going to vote with their feet in a way, I think, on March the 2nd when there are parliamentary elections. I think there's going to be a record low turnout because people have no faith in the candidates that are being allowed to run.
The other thing, of course, that we're hearing about day after day after day is whether or not Israel is going to attack Iran this year. Is there a reason for concern about this, and why is there so much talk about it?
There is a reason for concern. I think that there certainly are elements within Israel that would like to mount some sort of preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear program before it gets any further advanced. But the reason all the noise is out there is because there's a big disagreement within Israel about whether this is wise. Most of the military and intelligence establishment actually doesn't think it's a very good idea. And the Obama administration is not keen on this. So they keep saying things that essentially smoke out those in Israel who are opposed to a strike. They're trying to preempt the preemptors, is the way I put it. in an article I've got up on the AlMonitor.com website today. You know, this would have all kinds of ramifications that could be very harmful, frankly, for Israeli interests, but certainly for the United States, since the retaliation would likely fall on Americans in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, of course, we would have a huge spike in oil prices. We've already seen the price of oil go up and the price of gasoline go up in this country. It's always been my view that if the United States and Iran were to sit down and have serious negotiations, the price of oil would drop $20 a barrel overnight.
Oh, my. There was an interesting article in the Times yesterday about if Israel decided to launch this strike on Iran, how incredibly difficult it would be for them to do so. And it questioned whether or not they would be able to fly mm-hmm. all the miles, not refuel, get back to Israel, fly through unfriendly space, etc.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of all this noise about an Israeli attack, I mean, what the Israelis would like is for the United States to do the job for them, because they really are not capable of doing enough damage to make the consequences worth it. I mean, that's basically the issue. And I think, you know, if the Israelis were really serious about doing something, we wouldn't be hearing all this chatter. Because when Israel is about to do something like strike a military program in a Muslim country, usually it does it very quietly, and we hear about it afterwards. We don't hear all this noise before.
And there, the question has also been raised, would the U.S. really like the Israelis to do this for them?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the message has been abundantly clear. If you heard Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, on CNN on Sunday, he said, no, please don't. We don't need this now. This is not a good idea. It's not necessary. As far as we know, the Iranians have not yet made a decision to build a nuclear weapon. And, you know, an attack by Israel, frankly, would be the one thing that might convince them that they really need nukes to deter future attacks. So because of the likely consequences, because a strike would not hit much of the program, which is dispersed, which is underground, for many reasons, the United States does not want Israel to attack Iran and does not want to be put in a position of having to do it itself.
We'll go to phone calls. We have many of them for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and we're talking about Iran this hour of the program. Our guest the first half hour is Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center, Washington correspondent for a new website that is devoted to the Middle East, almonitor.com, al-monitor.com. We start with Dan in Three Lakes. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Somewhat off the topic, but, you know, we wonder why people in the Middle East are not fond of Americans, and we forget our own history. We don't remember. There's a reason why the Marine Corps hymn has a phrase in it, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. The first time the United States government sent the Marine Corps to the Middle East to rescue missionaries that were nosing into Islamists, trying to convert them to Christianity, the country was only 20 years old. It was 1797. And since then, there has never been a period of more than 30 or 40 years that the U.S. government did not have to send military people to go rescue missionaries from the Middle East. We should stay home and mind our own Christian business. It is not our business. And I doubt very much whether there's an American citizen now existing or ever in the history of the country that's had an Islamist knocking on his front door.
Barbara.
It's a very interesting comment. I think the main reason we get involved these days is because of oil. And I would add to the caller's very interesting comments that we should get off fossil fuel, and then we really wouldn't have to care about what happens in the Middle East. The main reason we're there now is to protect the oil that flows down through the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, that comes from Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iran, you know, and that all our economies rely on. So the sooner we can break our addiction to fossil fuels, the sooner we will not have to worry about sending the Marines out there.
Thanks, Dan, for the call. Mark in Richland Center. Hi.
Good morning. To follow up on what he said, you know, you mentioned the revolution from 30-something years ago. That was simply to get rid of an imposed government that had come at our own action. So there is a reason why the Iranians don't want us interfering in their government. Secondly, the trading that they're doing for real goods is actually more real than what you mentioned with regard to hard currency, because the currency that is now sort of in position of trying to impose something on them is virtually worthless. You don't want debt-based dollars or debt-based euros. You watch the fall of Greece, you're going to watch the fall of Portugal, Spain, Italy as well, because their currencies are based on debt. So the real money in trading real goods for real oil is actually much more sensible on the part of the Iranians.
Very interesting comments. First, the caller is right that the 79 revolution was to get rid of the Shah, who was put back on the throne in 53 with a CIA coup. So you're absolutely right on that. On your other point, I think I beg to differ a little bit. We still have a financial system that involves things like wire transfers and letters of credit and normal ways of doing trade, which is not through the cumbersome means of barter. And even when they are trading goods in this way, they have to evaluate the worth of them, and they do that in dollar or euro values. So whether it's debt-based or not, it's the way we measure the worth of things. And for the Iranians, this has just been so difficult, especially for the private businesses that are having a terrible time now importing materials for small factories and so on. It's really causing a lot of dislocation in the economy there.
More phone calls in a moment. Iran is our area of discussion this hour. Barbara Slavin, our first guest. She is the author of a book on Iran entitled Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. She is a Washington correspondent for a new website, which you may want to look at, devoted to the Middle East, Al Monitor. That's al-monitor.com. And we'll take more phone calls in a moment. The number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Raj in Madison. Hi, Raj.
Good morning. I'm calling about this issue of a nuclear Iran being an existential threat to Israel. I personally think that it is a phony issue that the Israel is using to mobilize the American Jewish community behind it because of a great deal of ignorance. There is absolutely no way Iran can deliver a nuclear weapon in Israel anywhere without in the process killing tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of Palestinian Muslims. And no Iranian leader in his right mind would consider doing that. I personally think that it would be much easier for Israel, with all of its nuclear weapons, to deliver a nuclear weapon on many of the major Islamic cities without having to worry about killing any Jews.
Barbara.
I tend to agree that the nuclear threat certainly has been exaggerated. Iran will not ever send a nuclear weapon against Israel. It would be suicidal, and the caller is absolutely right. It would kill enormous numbers of Muslims as well as Jews. But becoming a nuclear power would make Iran at least seem to be a more powerful country in the region. It might embolden the Iranians in terms of some of their other policies, their support for groups. You might see more hedging on the part of the Arab countries in the region, a greater willingness to take Iran's views into account. And, of course, you might see more proliferation. Countries like Saudi Arabia, Turkey might seek to get their own nuclear weapons. So there are plenty of reasons to be concerned about Iran getting a nuclear weapon without believing that it is an existential threat to Israel. I don't believe it is.
What are the military exercises that Iran announced yesterday that it's conducting to, they say, boost protection of its nuclear sites? Southern Iran military exercises. What are those, Barbara?
Oh, again, this is part, I think, of the propaganda war, in a way, that's going on back and forth. You know, the United States and Israel say all options are on the table, and we send our ships through the Straits of Hormuz, so Iran is responding and showing that it's in a position to inflict harm if the United States or Israel were to attack. It has a doctrine of asymmetric power, of swarming American ships with small boats. It has a lot of missiles that it could send, not just to attack American targets, but also to hit Saudi oil fields or the oil platforms of other countries in the region. So it's a mutual muscle flexing that's going on between the United States and Iran.
Richard in Fort Atkinson, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm very pleased about the first several callers who have taken the trouble to mention antecedent events to the current situation in Iran, especially the chap who talked about the overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953 and what the conditions that we imposed upon Iran since that time. So all you have to do, though, is look at a map, and you can see that the United States, through its military power, has placed hostile military forces all around the periphery of Iran. Then you ask the question, why is that? Has Iran invaded anyone? And the answer is no. Have we invaded Iran? The answer is basically yes. We were the government that provoked Saddam Hussein and sponsored Saddam Hussein under Kissinger to invade Iran in the early 80s. Consequently, it seems to me that we do not, we are myopic. We do not look in the mirror. We complain about Iran's pathological government, but we don't look at our pathological government, which has become over the world murder incorporated with secret association assassinations, black ops, drones, and projecting military power in just about every country on the face of the planet, and at home destroying our own civil liberties. For example, nobody talks about today the fact that we have lost all rights of habeas corpus due to Presidents Bush and now Mr. Obama. So it seems to us we ought to climb down a little bit from this hyperbolic rhetoric and get on to the efforts and energies of peace.
Barbara.
Well, I take issue. I think you're presenting presenting a rather extreme view of U.S. intervention. I agree with some of it, but in terms of the Iran-Iraq war, I think that was Saddam Hussein's own decision to invade Iran in 1980. He perceived that Iran, which had just had a revolution, which was holding U.S. hostages, was in a very weak state, and he decided he would try to take advantage of that by grabbing the oil-producing province of Iran, Khuzestan. So the United States did subsequently support Saddam Hussein, as did most of the rest of the world, because they were so afraid of the Iranian Revolution spreading. And the Iranian Revolution, of course, was virulently anti-American, perhaps for good reason. But I think the caller exaggerates that a little bit.
And finally, Barbara, I want to ask you, because I don't know if they're talking together, coming up with a list of questions, trying to persuade Iran to enter these negotiations, but what's the background of the Iran Six, the five permanent members of the UN and Germany? They're in discussions now to figure out what they should be talking to Iran about. Should there be new negotiations?
Well, this is a grouping that originated under the George W. Bush administration, and it was a way for the United States to lead from behind, shall we say. I still think the U.S. and Iran need to sit down and talk one-on-one. But this group now is trying to decide how to respond to a letter that was sent by the chief Iranian nuclear negotiator just a week or so ago. He in turn was replying to a letter from the P5 plus one that was sent last October. So we don't detect a huge amount of eagerness on the part of either side to get back to the talks. Part of the problem, I think, is that the Iranians don't perceive that they're going to get any kind of face-saving proposal. They're worried that they're going to be asked to make concessions that they're not yet ready to make. So, my hope, frankly, is that we can just get through this American election year, get through to next November without anything unfortunate happening in the way of an accidental escalation or miscalculation. And then I hope we can get down to some serious negotiations with the Iranians on not just on their nuclear program, but on a number of other issues of concern.
You've been there a number of times. You must have pretty strong feelings about the country.
I do. I'm extremely fond of the Iranian people. I've met some absolutely fabulous people there. I think that, you know, people are well-educated and sophisticated and artistic and talented. You just have to see this new movie, A Separation, if you want to get an idea of the level of Iranian talent and sophistication in the arts. And so I just, you know, I hope that at some point they get a government that is more to their liking. I just worry that all the international pressure and saber-rattling winds up, you know, enforcing, frankly, the worst governments in Iran, that it helped produce this very hard-line regime that we see now. So I hope we can ratchet down the tensions, and I think that would be good for both sides.
Thank you, Barbara, so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center, Washington correspondent for this new website devoted to the Middle East, Al Monitor, that's al-monitor.com. She's the author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation, and she is a veteran journalist. She's been to Iran many times, and she's also written a book on Iranian regional influence titled Mullahs, Money, and Militias, How Iran Exerts Its Influence in the Middle East. Same topic, we're just switching guests the next half hour of the program, and we'll still be welcoming your phone calls. Joining us for the remainder of this hour is Professor Dilshad Ashalov, Professor of Political Science at East Tennessee University. His teaching interests are in the areas of Middle East politics, political methodology, comparative politics, democratization, and comparative political analysis. He is particularly interested in the politics of the Islamic world, politics in general, and the politics of the Middle East, Central Asia, and comparative democratization in particular. He is fluent in four languages and has conducted multiple field studies in the Middle East and Central Asia. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our lines have been very busy this morning, and so there is one opening right now, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Ashalov, thank you very much for being with us.
It was my pleasure to be here.
It was the hope of our last guest, who ended her segment by saying it was her fervent hope that we can get through the period before the election in this country, because we've had so much ratcheted up rhetoric, that she is worried that there might be something that could trigger an event that everybody would be unhappy about should such an event happen. Are we kind of walking on eggs here that don't have very thick shells, and there could be a possibility of some event happening that could really trigger a disaster?
I'm afraid so, as the tension is all-time high in the Middle East, especially in the Persian Gulf area, and unfortunately the likelihood for a major military confrontation is high, and the tension is building up, which could lead to a major catastrophic conflict in the region, which will affect the whole world in many aspects.
And what could prevent that?
First of all, if the military action is taken against Iran, against Iranian nuclear installations, to begin with, the first effect will be on the global oil markets. The price of oil will skyrocket, which will really send the recovery of the world financial crisis into ruins, and you can do the math how big of a toll will take that from the global economy, especially in the United States. If the economy is trying to get back on its feet, but if the oil goes up, and it will if the conflict erupts in the Middle East, because we know that Iran will most probably will target and attack the oil shipments that go through Persian Gulf, and to add that, it could be the matter of time once the military action starts that other countries in the Middle East, such as Saudi Arabia or United Arab Emirates or Qatar or small countries, could also be involved, which could really put the oil fields and refineries at stake, and that's going to be a disaster on economics aspect of it. But on the other hand, if the military action is taken, we cannot really predict what the outcome could lead to, because that's the nature of the war and uncertainties. Where the Iran will retaliate with its full scale. And could use its proxy forces in Lebanon, Hezbollah, and if the Saudis or United Arab Emirates or Qatar or my smaller countries will join in, then you can see the major large-scale conflict erupting, which can actually lead to the Sunni versus Shi'i clashes, and the whole region will be in turmoil. And this is definitely something that everybody is trying to and should avoid.
And what would prompt a military attack?
Well, the Israeli officials have made it clear enough that they are seriously considering a preemptive strike on Iran nuclear facilities on the premise that it will be too late if they do not act quickly. And the reason is that Iran will be beyond the reach of stopping its program, then it's going to be fruitless to attack later on. But the European and in U.S. intelligence agencies is sharply disagree with that statement, is that the military strike could only delay the nuclear program for only a year or two, but will not totally eradicate the nuclear program. So if Iran is to be attacked to take the nuclear program off or left alone, either way, the current situation, or in either cases, Iranian nuclear program is posing a major security dilemma in the region in terms of further arms race in the region. Therefore, Iran is committed and will probably continue with its nuclear program, which will further, we'll be talking about this for a while. But I'd like to just make one specific point here. If we kind of step back from this whole issue and I kind of reflect on the underlying issue of this whole crisis, or the nuclear technology by itself, we have to kind of realize that the future is actually goes hand-in-hand with the nuclear technology. Nuclear technology is our future, and the world will be investing and will be building probably more reactors, overall. Just a few weeks ago, the federal government has approved two new nuclear reactors to be built here in the U.S., in Georgia, and it's going to be a matter of time as the demand for electricity soars that people will be investing for nuclear technology. So, not only Iran, but other countries in the Middle East, you know, the Turkey, the Saudis, or the Egyptians, very soon will be building their own reactors. It's just a matter of time. And so in the long period, in the long range, this is something unavoidable, and we shouldn't really blame anybody seeking those new investments, because the electricity consumption is gonna rise. Just imagine we used to have only one computer in our households, and now we have those multiple computers in our house. We keep adding new devices, electronic devices, plugging them into the electric outlets, and consuming more and more electricity. This means that will have to come up with more sources of energy. Renewable energies are great, but nuclear technology is there to stay, so it's not going to go away anytime soon. Therefore, the sooner we realize and start coping and planning ahead of time, or thinking ahead of time how we're going to live in that environment, the better it will be to really concentrate on developing some new coping mechanisms or management mechanisms of living in the nuclear age.
Of course, the concern is that Iran's nuclear program is geared toward making weapons. Iran says that is not the case. With the UN inspectors having arrived in Iran yesterday for the second time in a short period of time, what is the likelihood that they're going to be able to determine the answer to that question? What would they need to look at to find out whether or not this is purely a peaceful pursuit on the part of Iran?
It is really tricky because it's very tricky to what extent the IAEA officials can really track evidence, because it's really contingent upon the Iranian collaboration, to the extent how genuinely they're willing to share the facility resources or the information with the officials. But what can be done is to look at from the computer, records, or looking at reports, or actually observing the facilities and seeing what kind of processes are being conducted in multiple sites within Iran could offer some clues. But again, it's not going to be something hardcore evidence which will link to Iran's own weapons program, or even if they do not find anything credible, would not mean that Iran is not developing a nuclear capability. But what is clear, though, Iran is boldly advancing in the direction that it can theoretically produce a new bomb capable, or the nuclear weapons-grade systems in 1 to 5 years.
Two phone calls for you in just a moment. Our guest this half hour as we talk about Iran is Dilshad Ashlov, professor of political science at East Tennessee University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. He has conducted multiple field studies in the Middle East and also in Central Asia, and his particular interests are in the politics of the Middle East, Central Asia, and democratization. To you momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two calls now. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to come at this from two angles, one which is obvious and one which is more oblique. The obvious point is that we have to take heroic measures to network both locally, statewide, and nationwide to contact the president and resist any involvement in war through us or through the Israelis with Iran. The second one is to express my disappointment in the lack of leadership and the selectivity of leadership by people who ought to be doing more on this. And the example I'd offer is Cardinal Dolan's approach to things. Ostensibly, Cardinal Dolan is pro-life, but he relates to a piddly-diddly issue in terms of the contraception, but he ignores Iran. Under the Beatitudes, of course, we say, blessed are the peacemakers. And so it seems to me if he was following the Beatitudes, he'd be talking to people about avoiding war with Iran, and he'd also teach people about the kind manipulations that people use to engage people in war. But he wants to be the Saint Timorous, the patron saint of Pharisees, because what he does is he ignores really serious issues so that he can pander to his wealthy Catholic base, which is what he really wants to appeal to, when he ought to be talking about serious issues in the first place.
All right, well, let's ask about who the peacemakers are in this whole process. Who should be at the table, perhaps? Who's not? Who's being effective, Professor Ashlov, in trying to broker some kind of peace here?
Do you mean the on the side of the U.S. officials who is going to bring a more peaceful resolution? You mean?
Actually, anybody in the world.
Well, yeah, well, the thing is, it's really for now the time for the United Nations Security Council to come together, because they are the veto holders, if you will. They have the ultimate veto powers on major UN resolutions. Who makes critical decisions have to come together and really genuinely move forward what can be done. But if we kind of think in terms of peace-building process, the majority of the world leaders, the European and Western and Asian countries, believe that the war should be avoided and the tendency is in that direction, not to let the war to erupt. But Israel, on the other hand, is also concerned by its own security in the region. It's being threatened and views Iran as an existential threat. The countries around the world have different various opinions of whether Iran is a direct existential threat or not. But one thing is clear, it's not the fear of Iran will directly attack if he has a nuclear weapon, but the problem is when Iran acquires nuclear weapons that it could end up in the wrong hands. In that case, it could be Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is on the border, the northern border of Israel, which will be a major security threat. So Israel is really wants something to be done. Israel does not really wants to go to war or start a war directly, but is claiming he's running out of time, that something has to be done. But on the other hand, the world leaders have to come out, and we haven't seen that yet. Especially Chinese and Russians have been relatively silent. The U.S. has been more outspoken about the issue, but we really have to see some other countries, especially from Russia and China, to be more active role in preventing this conflict. They are making statements, Russia and Chinese officials, but when it comes to actions or producing some creative solutions, they have been relatively silent. So it does take the whole world community to come up with a long-lasting solution.
Well, they're evidently, according to our previous guest, doing business with Iran. They're bartering with Iran.
Of course. China and Russia, they have a military and they have trade and other relations going on. But on the other hand, the likelihood for miscalculation and the war erupting is increasing on a daily basis. So we're kind of working in a very thin line that any miscalculation in the Persian Gulf could lead to a major military confrontation. And of course, we shouldn't discount that Iran, Russia, and China will not stop supporting them. They have a vested interest to protect Iran because Iran is a major outlet of Russian and Chinese influence in the Middle East region. So they do not they want to maintain their leverage on that part of world. But again, everybody acts on their own interests. That's when things will get more complicated. So this is the time, if the war or major conflict is to be avoided, everyone has to do some form of compromise. Otherwise, the options are not great.
Brian in Menasha is next. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine.
Good.
I was wondering, my gun is no good without bullets, and I guess Iran has no uranium, so which country is supplying the uranium for them, and why don't we go after them?
Professor? Hello? Hello? We'll have to try to reconnect with him. I'm sorry, Brian. We'll just listen to your comment and try to reconnect with him in a moment. Thank you.
All right.
Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our guest, we just lost contact with him for a moment, is Professor Dilshad Ashalov, Professor of Political Science at East Tennessee University. Are you with us again?
Yes, I'm sorry. I think we got lost for a second.
Okay, I was worried about you because I kept hearing a horn honking and I didn't know what was going on. yeah, all right. It was the car alarm. All right, that's what it was. Oh, what a day. Let's go to Alan in Chicago. Hi, Alan.
Hi. The previous caller had an interesting question about where Iran is getting their uranium. Iran is a very uranium-rich country. Because the previous caller just said, let's go after the country that's providing them with uranium. So that's the answer to that question. I'm not trying to take the place of your guest. However, I do have a question for your guest. Knowing the behavior of this regime in Iran for the last 30 years, that they have never taken a step backward. As a matter of fact, they have been very aggressive in taking first steps towards their adversaries, such as hostage-taking, and then the 8-year war with Iraq, which on numerous occasions they had an opportunity for ceasefire, and Iranians refused ceasefire. And then attacking oil tankers in the Persian Gulf during that time. Knowing their persona and their characteristics, we can establish that should they get attacked, that pretty much all hell is going to break loose in the Middle East. And it's going to really affect the balance of power, unlike anything we have seen in the previous 30, 40 years. Where do you think do you think China is going to feel threatened? And if so, do you think that's why they keep vetoing things that come up in Security Council against Iran? And should an all-out military campaign break out against Iran, where do you think they are going to come in? Do you think they're going to sit idle on the sidelines, or do you think they're going to enter the war? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan, for calling.
Yeah, it's a great question. I do not think that China or Russia will directly enter the war. However, you know, if you look at the past and analyze the past Iran-Iraqi war in the 80s, the Russia and China in particular, was a major arms supplier, weapons supplier during the war. So we can see the China or Russia taking an active role by supplying with weapons and munitions if the war is to take place. But I do not think they will be directly involved. But, you know, we know that if you see that from Chinese perspective, China, Russia, and five Central Asian countries have the so-called Asian NATO or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and Iran and Pakistan remain to be main key observers in the region. So so China and Russia, they have their own security measures, and they see Iran as aligned with the East, with the Chinese and Russians, and therefore direct support will be provided by those countries, although they will not be directly involved in the warfare. But I don't think Chinese wants to see a wide-scale war either, because China buys the bulk of Iranian oil, and they don't want to see that oil supply to be cut off, and they're also concerned about the global oil price that can skyrocket and cripple the economies. They surely do not want to see any confrontation as well, but if confrontation used to occur, they will probably end up on the Iranian side and supporting them from that perspective. But talking about irrationality behavior of Iranian regime, yes, they could be unstable, but they are relatively rational and when we compare to Kim Jong Il, who recently died in North Korea. The North Koreans, who actually was believed to have some form of nuclear capacity, has been a lot more crazy and irrational in the past compared to Iranians. But Iran has attacked those shipments or who has been involved in invasive activities during the war, but we do not have a long list or a proven record of Iranians actually going out and attacking or other countries. So the large scale Iran has more or less defensive for the last 15-20 years, and Iran is really concerned and may act by miscalculation when there's no communication within the other Western countries involved in the crisis. And there's a chance that miscalculation can occur, and Iran has made it very clear that it can attack the oil shipment and tankers in the Persian Gulf, and which can lead to a domino effect of chaotic events.
Yeah. Well, they also have a history of attacking their own people, which isn't very promising.
Yes, well, you know, Iran has a history of dealing with his problems and has been really fighting with the North, with the Kurds, Iranian Kurds, or the PKK organization who is trying to establish a Kurdistan in that part of the world. And they have been also been fighting, and they've had instances where Iranian officials had a very tough kind of crackdown on those who are critical of the regime. If we go back to Iran-Iraqi war, Saddam Hussein was the one who gassed his own people in the north and killing the thousands of Kurds in the north. So we haven't seen that scale of irrationality from Iranian side. Iran is an authoritarian, theocratic country, and is not going to hesitate to use violence if it's going to take against own people to prevent the regime. And we have to keep that in mind. And Iran is now the main supporter of Syrian regime, who is killing its own people. And we've heard many reports that Iranian backed undercover military officials are actually helping Bashar al-Assad as we speak to crack down on the uprisings within Syria.
Thank you very much for being with us. Our guest this half hour, Professor Dilshad Ashlov. He is a professor of political science at East Tennessee University. And we also thank Barbara Slavin for being with us this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks for all of your phone calls. You were highly involved in this hour, which is always good. Great conversations ahead, so please stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.